Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I am your host, Daniel Meyer, and I'm really pleased to be joined today by Greg Plotkin, who is a, quote, strategist for food and agriculture nonprofits. That title, even though Greg came up with it all by himself, still doesn't really do justice to the breadth of work that he does, but we'll get into that in just a second. I'm not only excited to have Greg on the show because he is a very sharp and well-spoken advocate for farmland preservation, among other things, as you'll see, but also selfishly because he is a friend and he lives all the way across the country in California, and I'm so thrilled to have the opportunity to catch up with him and talk with him a bit about food. So, Greg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Daniel.
My pleasure. Before we jump in, you are, as I sort of alluded to in your little intro, you're one of those people who kind of has their hands in a lot of different things in the food world. Will you just give us a quick rundown, or a long one, if that's how long it takes, of all the sorts of different things you're up to, and then we can kind of figure out from there which strands to tug on after that?
Sure. And I guess I'll give you a little background on how I got involved in food and agriculture to begin with.
Yeah, please.
So even though I do live in California now, I'm a native of the East Coast. I grew up in Connecticut. I worked on a farm there in high school. It was a fruit and vegetable farm mostly. We also planted a vineyard, which I guess is about 10 years ago now. The farm bottled its wine on site. After that, I went to school in Washington, D.C. and started working at the DuPont Circle Farmers Market there for some farms from Maryland and Pennsylvania. After that, I moved to upstate New York to work for the world-famous Flying Pigs Farm for a little while, which I know you are familiar with, Daniel.
Yes, that is where I met Greg, up at Flying Pigs Farm.
Yes, yes. But during this whole time, I have been doing grant writing, fundraising for food and agriculture nonprofits. It's taken on a lot of different themes, farmland protection, nutrition, food access. But mainly I work for organizations that in some way or another are interested in the future of food and agriculture.
And how did you get into grant writing in the first place? It seems like a pretty specialized and sort of difficult skill. Did you fall into it, or did you sort of, you know, carefully cultivate it? How'd you learn how to do it?
It's definitely a very specialized skill. Luckily for me, I sort of fell into it. One of the organizations I work for, American Farmland Trust, it was actually my first job out of college, an entry-level job, and I had a lot of experience in agriculture, and so I think that they were excited that I was so excited about working for a farmland conservation organization, and I always was a strong writer, but I definitely fell into it without any prior grant writing experience before, but it's sort of a gap in the food world. There aren't a lot of people that, you know all the sources of money that different food and ag projects can go towards.
So are you in high demand?
I am in high demand, and I think people like me are in high demand.
Well, that's good to know. Everybody out there, learn how to write a grant and you'll have a job. So I guess if we have any time later, and hopefully we do, I'd love to touch sort of generally on your role as a grant writer and a fundraiser for food and agriculture programs. But since you mentioned American Farmland Trust, I wonder if maybe we just start with that and talk about that organization a little bit, and sort of generally about the topic of farmland protection. Can you sort of paint us a a broad picture of what's happening, or what American Farmland Trust does, what you do for them, and sort of what might be happening to farmland in this country that is a bit concerning.
Sure. Yeah, we can break that apart into a couple questions. So, American Farmland Trust, it's a national nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. Regional offices all around the country, from the East Coast to the West Coast, mainly in areas where farmland is most threatened to be developed. It's a 33-year-old nonprofit organization. We were founded in 1980 by Peggy Rockefeller. And since then, sort of the real focus of American Farmland Trust work has been on the policy front since then, trying to encourage policies and programs that really help farmers protect their land, stay profitable, and be good environmental stewards of it while they're farming it. And so that's sort of a very, very basic description of American Farmland Trust.
Yep.
In terms of how, you know, what the status of farmland loss is in the U.S. right now, it's bad. Every state in the country continues to lose farmland at a fairly alarming rate. The statistic that we use in New York is a farm is lost every 3.5 days, and that translates to 500,000 acres of farmland in New York that's been lost over the last 25 years.
And
wow. That's pretty, it's very representative of a lot of other areas in the country. So farmland loss, unfortunately, is concentrated very much around urban-influenced areas. So, you know, New York City, Boston, Washington, San Francisco, Seattle, as, you know, the urban population has grown over the last 50 years, development patterns have sort of shifted from being centered in urban areas to flowing outside of that. You know, everyone wants their 1 acre in picket fence, but that land has to come from somewhere, and unfortunately, most of the time, it's farmland.
So when you say farmland lost, you know, how is a farm lost typically? I mean, obviously, there's urban populations that are moving further and further out, and they want to develop the farmland. Is it because that land near cities is very expensive, and farms just aren't economically viable enough to pay for the land, or the farmers' hands being forced by not just small developers but big ones? How and why are farms lost so frequently?
So it's an interesting question, and I think it points to some of the difficulties in addressing farmland loss at a national level, mm-hmm. because the issues involving why farmland is lost to development is very different depending on where you live.
Right.
You know, as you alluded to, in New York and New England, the cause is very much the price of land. You know, you're around New York, you're around Boston, the price to buy an acre of land is incredibly expensive. In the Midwest, you know, places that have sort of less, you know, less development pressure, less demand for housing, a lot of the issues there are actually farm transfers, you know. So, you know, a father will be farming land that his family has farmed for many years, but, you know, oftentimes now there's so many more opportunities out there that children don't always want to stay on the farm and continue with their, you know, family's legacy. And so in places like that, the issue is actually finding someone to, you know, continue to farm the land.
Interesting.
And, you know, yeah, and, you know, and in California, the issue, you know, that everyone talks about here is water, access to it, and the price of it. And so farmland is lost for, you know, a variety of reasons, but, you know, when farms aren't profitable, no matter where they are, that tends to be the one last straw that, you know, breaks the camel's back, so to speak, and why farmers sell their land to, you know, a developer.
Right. So I guess, you know, one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show, and a reason why I think, you know, your work fits so well into the theme of this particular show, which is sort of using food as a vehicle for some sort of social good, is that, you know, when you talk about farmland loss, it's obviously, it's rooted in agriculture, but the implications of the disappearance of farmland go so much further beyond food. Do you just want to speak a little bit about what some of those consequences are? You know, when farms start disappearing, what's the chain reaction that sets into effect?
Sure, and you know, not to state this too dramatically, but you know, a lot of times when farms start failing, communities start failing. Because you think about rural areas, the farms that are in those areas support a lot of services. They support veterinarians, they support, you know, auto mechanics, they support, you know, the local feed store. And, you know, without farms to sell these services and items to, whole communities, you know, tend to fail. So that's one part of it. Also, another consequence can be environmental consequences. When you put a housing development or a mall or, you know, something like that on farmland, it's lost forever. And it's almost impossible to manage land as environmentally sensitively with development as you could with farmland. And, you know, I'm not saying that every farm in the country is, you know, managed as well as it could be.
Right.
But if it's not farmland, there's no potential to improve upon, you know, how you work that land.
Right. So what happens to these? Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so it's, you know, there's a very real economic consequence of losing farmland. There's a very real environmental consequence of losing farmland. And, I mean, obviously, there is the issue of food access. And most states at this point have lost so much farmland that they cannot feed themselves with the land that they have contained within their borders, which might not seem like a big deal with sort of the, you know, multinational food system that
right.
we have now. But we don't really know how long, you know, fuel is going to be affordable enough to be shipping food around the country.
Right. So once that supply line for transportation is cut off, pretty much nobody is self-sufficient anymore, is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm sure a lot of the Midwest states could be self-sufficient, but most of them grow very few specialty crops, you know, very few fruits and vegetables. It's mainly commodity items such as corn and soy.
Right. I was curious when I was thinking a little bit about sort of the disappearance of farms, and obviously that means the disappearance of food sources. You know, you hear a lot lately about, you know, our sort of rapidly increasing population and how in 2050 we're going to have, you know, 10 billion people or whatever it is, and how we need to ratchet up our food production by 70% or whatever it is globally, and you know, we bear some of that burden. How does that fit into the conversation about the lack of or the disappearance of farmland? Is there a palpable sense that we're not producing, that America is not going to be able to produce as much food as it's always been proud to produce, or is that not part of the conversation?
Well, the way that the food system has developed as transportation lines have grown is that, you know, countries and, you know, specifically areas within countries really focus on their competitive advantage. They produce, you know, what they are best suited to produce as much as they can, you know, think citrus in Florida, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's left a lot of states and a lot of communities that are really focused on producing a few items, but certainly not, you know, everything that you might need to sustain yourself.
Right. So you talked earlier about, I just want to go back to the idea of one of the reasons why farmlands are being lost is that there's just nobody to take over the family business, or there's not, you know, somebody waiting in the wings ready to, farm. How do you sort of, I know one of the pressing issues is that, farmers in this country tend to have a pretty high, average age. Maybe it's even somewhere in the high 50s or low 60s, something like that. How do you sort of facilitate and create a new generation of farmers? How do you get them skills and land and capital to sort of get started and get ready to take over where these people are leaving off?
Right, and I think you alluded to a lot of the problems. You know, in my opinion, I think the demand of young people to farm is there. I think the problem is the barriers to actually starting to farm are significant. You obviously have access to land. If you don't inherit land from your family, having to find affordable land sort of within a geographic area that allows you to have a market for whatever you produce is difficult.
Right.
In order to buy that land, you need some sort of capital, whether that, you know, is a loan from a farm service agency or, you know, an investment from someone. It's the ways of accessing capital, I think, are difficult to navigate. You know, it's the same as looking for a loan or an investment in any other business. And I think for some reason, people, when they think it's a farm, they don't think it's as involved or as difficult as it would be for another business, but it is.
Interesting.
And then the skills of how to farm. Farming is a specialized business. It's not something that people, you know, they're not skills that people are born with. And unless you have grown up in a farming family, odds are you might know how to grow food, but you don't know how to, you know, stagger planting. You don't know how to use cover crops. You don't know how to use drip irrigation. And so there's certainly a huge learning curve as well. And so I would say the three main barriers are access to land, access to capital, and then just access to the knowledge of how to produce food.
It's a lot of barriers to jump through. Okay, I want to pick up on this strand in just a second. We need to take a quick break, but we're talking farmland conservation with Greg Plotkin. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Let me love you, baby. I'll make everything all right. Oh, yes, I will.
You're listening to All You Got to Do by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Keep it locked for more good food with Daniel Meyer.
To see you so broke down. To make him understand, all you got to do is let me love you, baby. I'll make everything alright. Oh, yes, I will.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Greg Plotkin. So, Greg, right before the break, we were talking about the three pretty significant barriers to new farmers getting in the farming game, which are the difficulty in accessing land, accessing some capital to start up, and just accessing the skills and knowledge they need to have viable farms. So, those are the barriers. I'm wondering what's the relief? What are the support systems that either, you know, they have recourse to or need to be put in place to allow young people to get farming or to incentivize young people to get in farming? Does AFT do any of that work, or are there government programs that you guys rely on?
Sure. And I guess if you don't mind, I'd like to add a fourth barrier that I think I neglected to mention, and that would be access to markets, you know. Obviously, if you're going to be a farmer and you're going to be producing a food product, you need to have a market to sell that through. And so a lot of people who may be entering the profession without, marketing experience or experience, you know, selling food products either directly to consumers or the more commercial route, I think that is obviously something that would make it very hard to enter farming as well. But I guess to answer your question about what remedies there are out there, there are training programs. A lot of universities are now ramping up their sustainable agriculture education programs. The University of Vermont actually has several courses that they're offering this summer, I believe, to help people that are interested in starting farms sort of form a business plan. And a long-term vision for what they want their farm to look like. And
that's
I also believe that one of those is actually a online course if people are interested. And then American Farmland Trust does do a lot of the the training, but what we do is we focus on sort of service providers.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of, you know, instead of working one-on-one with farmers, we work a lot with, you know, state departments of agriculture, with a lot of agencies from universities. And basically what we do is we train these people in sort of the barriers that we talked about now, and we give them strategies for how to address them.
Okay, that's useful. So I kind of want to get to the one of my central questions, which is that you know, your mission as a grant writer and an American Farmland Trust's mission is to you know, sort of protect this productive farmland and stop it from being developed, and you've described all these reasons why it happens and why it happens so frequently. I'm wondering what are the various tools you guys have in your arsenal to stop that from happening? How do you mitigate it or slow it down a little bit?
Sure. So one of the things that AFT has done over the course of its 35-year history is we've actually established, I believe it's 27 now, state-level farmland protection programs.
Wow.
Whereas before 1980, there were none. There were no state-level farmland protection programs. And so in these 27 states around the country, we've actually helped these states lay some groundwork for how to plan for the future of their farmers. And in addition to sort of state-level work, we do a lot of planning work with communities, because in terms of land use decisions, a lot of these decisions are made at either a county or a city or a town level. And what AFT has found is that a lot of people that are responsible for making these land use decisions are often part of, you know, a volunteer board. And mm-hmm. so they may not have any real experience in land use planning at all, but are making some sort of long-term decisions about the future of what their community will look like. And so what AFT tries to do is sort of arm these decision makers with the knowledge about how to craft certain legislation and policies to help protect farmland. And, you know, smart growth strategies, high-density development is something that we're really championing out here in California, but also across the country.
So what are those, I mean, what might some of those sort of local land use ordinances look like? Are they stipulations that certain pieces of land can never be developed? Is there certain caveats that come with development that sort of, you know, require some level of protection? How does that work on the grassroots level?
So I'll give you a current example out here. You know, California's San Joaquin Valley is, you know, one of the you know, greatest agricultural gems in the world,
right?
Incredibly productive. But the cities that are within the valley are continuing to see population increases, and so they're having to deal with sprawl. And so one thing that some of the cities in the valley are considering is actually formulating an urban growth boundary.
Mm-hmm.
It'll basically put a limit on to how far residential development can move out into the valley. And so that would force them basically to have to focus on higher density development to maximize the space that they already have, instead of just spreading further and further out into the valley and taking up more farmland.
Interesting. And I imagine developers push back on these sorts of proposals all the time?
Yes, they do. You know, developers obviously want to put as many houses on, you know, as many small lots as they can. So we find ourselves at odds with them regularly. But there are some that recognize the importance of farmland. Obviously, developers have to eat too, you know.
Right. True.
And
good
so
point.
There are some that, you know, try to mitigate the loss as much as possible.
Great point. So, I mean, some of these things you're talking, most of these things you're talking about sort of happen on the level of community or local or state governments. I'm wondering, does the Farm Bill fit into this conversation anywhere? You know, it's been proposed, it's hotly debated. You know, does the stuff that's in that legislation come to bear on the work that you do?
It does, and I believe that the Senate voted to end debate on the farm bill, the current farm bill, today, and they're going to have the final vote on it at 5:30 p.m. East Coast time on Monday, for those that are interested.
Okay.
But a lot of, so, you know, as people know, the main part of the farm bill is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps,
right,
which is about 80% of the total bill. But the rest of it contains a lot of good programs that promote, you know, environmental conservation, local food systems, and, you know, what people have to realize is that a lot of the money that state departments of agriculture have and that they dole out is money that comes to them through the farm bill or like pieces of national level legislation.
So that might be those kinds of expenditures might sort of lead to the kinds of local or state programs that you guys rely on to help with, I don't know, education,
right,
or that sort of thing.
Sure, exactly.
And are those being preserved? Are they being bolstered? Are they endangered in this round? Do you know?
Well, I've been driving today, so I don't know what made it into the final bill, but I believe there is some good language in there for conservation and sort of tying crop insurance more closely to conservation practices on farms, which is something that
AFC
has been very focused on.
Okay, good. Well, I hope you're not driving now, but if you are, I'll try not to distract you for too much longer.
I'm not.
Okay, good.
Do you mind if I bring up one more topic while we still have time?
Please, you can run the show.
Awesome. So one thing that I want to talk about is ag in the middle. So these are farms that I would say that are too big to be doing farmers markets and selling direct to consumers, but, you know, too small to be selling to grocery stores and, you know, other distributors. And these are the farms that are really most threatened by development because they have the hardest time finding a market for their product. And so I think a lot of what is happening within the food movement in terms of infrastructure building is really to help these sorts of farms, you know, processing plants and value-added kitchens and things like that. And even farm-to-school programs, I think one of the greatest potential markets for these, you know, farms, this ag in the middle, are school systems that, you know, maybe aren't going to buy enough to support, you know, a large farm, but, you know, these middle farms that are, you know, just seeking a market right now, they're really struggling.
Interesting. So you mentioned you know, processing facilities and community kitchens. Are those the main sort of pieces of infrastructure that these sort of farms in the middle need to produce products and at large enough a scale to get them into institutions like schools or, I don't know, hospitals or whatever it else might be?
Absolutely. And in addition to that, slaughterhouses, they are just such a significant barrier to getting more locally produced meat products, you know, into the hands of consumers. No matter how much the public wants it, and no matter how much farmers want to give it to the public, we're just handicapped by the ability of slaughterhouses to process products that quickly.
You're mentioning the term ag in the middle, which I'd never heard of before, and you know, sort of the idea that there are these farmers that are sort of getting lost in the shuffle makes me think about sort of where does farmland preservation and these issues sort of fall within the larger scope of, you know, the food movement to the extent that there is one. You know, there's a lot of different priorities and goals of the food movement, and a lot of them are very known and popular, and I feel like farmland preservation probably isn't one of those things. I'm wondering if you have a sense from your work about where this issue is situated within the larger consciousness of people and how you get it maybe higher up on the radar.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I've worked in the food movement for a long time now, and I've sort of been frustrated by the lack of focus that farmland protection gets from sort of the mainstream, you know, sustainable ag community, whether that, you know, nutrition, organics, local food, whatever.
Yeah.
The point is, there's a lot to fight about in the food movement, a lot to fight about. Everyone wants something different. But the one thing that I think we really need to come together on is farmland, because none of the fights matter. None of it matters if we don't have the land. And so I think anyone who works, you know, with food at all, should be very, very concerned about the rapid loss of farmland.
How do you, have any strategies for you know, getting people more aware about this sort of thing? I mean, I know it's tremendously hard to turn a culture in a new direction, but you know, how do we make this as popular as, you know, animal welfare or local food or some of these other issues that are sort of, you know, out front in the food movement?
I think the difficulty is making it real for people. You know, I think if someone in New York City, for example, mm-hmm. you know, went to the Union Square Farmers Market and saw that, you know, their favorite farmer wasn't there, and they asked the, you know, the farm stand, the green market person, what would happen, and they were like, oh, sorry, you know, Farmer Joe lost his farm, he's not going to be at the market anymore. You know, something like that, I think, would make it real for people, and you have that in the local food movement. You know, you have your relationships with your farmers and your fishers and your ranchers, and in, you know, the animal welfare, you see terrible, terrible pictures of what things can, or what, you know, humans can do to animals. And I think you need the same sort of thing in farmland preservation. You need it to strike a chord with people. And, you know, I'm always trying to figure out ways to do that with people that don't necessarily have a background in agriculture.
Interesting. It's funny because, you know, you go to the part of the charm of the farmer's market is like the close connection that you get with your farmers. But even so, it's still, you know, there's still this whole part that you can't really see and remains hidden, and you know, it still needs to be exposed.
Right, and you know what it takes to get your products from the farm to the farmer's market is it's extraordinary. Every week, what farmers put up with to get their products in front of you is really an extraordinary effort.
I know that you've done that for many, many weeks. You want to give us a quick little, we're almost out of time, but will you give us a quick little scenario about how hard it is to set up shop?
Sure. Well, when I used to drive down to New York City to do the Union Square and Grand Army Plaza farmers markets, my Thursdays would pretty much start at 6 a.m. and at 2 a.m. in New York City. Whew. And then my next day would start at 6 a.m. and a lot of driving, refrigerated box trucks around Manhattan. It's just it's an amazing feat.
Well, we are incredibly grateful that there are people like you who are willing to do it. Greg, I want to thank you so much for chatting with us today. It's really been a pleasure to catch up and hear from you. You guys have been listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and we'll talk to you again in a few weeks on the next episode of Good Food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.